Thank you. We just need to do a bit of switching over PowerPoints here, so we'll try and make that happen fairly quickly. Sorry about this.
And while she's doing that, can I just remind you about the hashtag, which is #2havetoholdcom. It was up there just now.
It's gone there,
so if you're tweeting, do use that hashtag.
Well, thank you very much for the invitation. I'm not quite sure I'm a specialist in the history of marriage, but I have, throughout my theological career, been really interested in the way in which gender, sexuality are dealt with in Christian history. And really what I'm going to do with you today in this paper is to think with you about some of the ways in which marriage has been dealt with in Christian history and tradition. I'm going to begin by looking at the New Testament. Well, I'm going to begin by looking at the Old Testament, actually, and then move on to looking at the New Testament. And then we're going to have a brief canter through Christian history. You realise for 45 minutes, that's about a century. Well, let's not work it out. But I hope you'll get some highlights. And what I'm hoping you'll see is that although we may talk about Christian marriage as, we may think we know what we mean by it, what I'm hoping you'll think by the end of this paper is that actually we're not at all sure what we mean by Christian marriage, and maybe that's quite a good place to start. I should also say it's just been the first week of semester in Glasgow. I am slightly coming down with fresher's flu, so I apologise for that. If I start sneezing in the middle of this, that's what that's about. Marriage has been much in the news recently, and that's partly because the British press, I think, has a prurient interest in marriage. And there was a thing going around Facebook some time ago. Sorry, that way of doing the lighting is dreadful for me because I now feel like I'm in a spotlight. Can we just readjust that?
Where we were before.
Sorry, that was fine before, but that's really bad for me because I've got shadows over everything. British press seems to have a prurient interest in marriage, and there was a thing circulating on Facebook a while back counting up how many times one of the film stars had been married, one time I think only just for 1 week, and saying, you know, what is it about heterosexual marriage that is so wonderful? It's particularly been in the press, of course, though, because we have been moving in the last year to the introduction of same-sex marriage as a legal possibility. And the churches, of course, have been struggling with that. I'm not going to particularly talk about that process, but I do think it has brought to the fore some of the questions that many people in the churches have been trying to avoid doing theology about for a lot of the last 20, 25 years. And that's part of what I am going to talk about in this paper. Marriage and sexuality, it seems to me, are emotive topics because they are fundamental to who we are. And that is as true for Christians as it is for anybody else. And that means that what we bring to this debate is rooted not only in what we think and we believe intellectually, but also in our lived experience. How each of us experiences our relationships with other people, if we're married, how we experience and live out our own marriage, if we're not married, how we experience other people's marriages, or how we experienced our parents' marriage, if they were married, all of those things shape how we come to this debate. I think there's a big gap, but for instance, between somebody like me who grew up in the 60s, was born in the 60s, with parents who were quite into the swinging 60s sides of things, and somebody whose parents, even in my own generation, who grew up with a family which was absolutely not into that kind of thing. You have a totally different attitude about what you think is right and what you think is wrong, simply because you grew up with different expectations within your own family. All of that shapes how we read scripture, how we read history, and also shapes, I think, how we understand the authority of the church and its remit, and what we allow it to tell us about how we ought to be living our lives. And I think one of the things we're experiencing at the moment, and Linda Woodhead's surveys have shown us this, is a radical split between what people say about authority of the church and how they actually live the authority of the church. But that's perhaps a discussion for another time. But I think it fits into thinking about questions about sexuality. And the Roman Catholic Church is a really great example here. It still bans contraception. I don't know personally, the Roman Catholics I know all use contraception. That may be a small sample. How do we allow the church to tell us what we should or shouldn't think? And how does the church respond to what we say we think? I think that's part of the tension that we're living out at the moment. All this is trying to get to a beginning of this paper, which says that we are living in complex times in how we think about authority over our own lives. And that means it's really difficult for us, I think, increasingly to actually hold together what we think we are as the church in terms of what its Christian teaching is and what it thinks it's trying to do. But I also think that recognising that all of us as Christ's disciples are trying to live out what we understand to be God's calling to us is not a bad place to start in this debate and might actually take some of the heat out of the problems. We care about these questions because we believe that God cares. It's clear to us all, I think, that in this debate, as so often, fundamental belief has led and leads Christians in very different directions. And sometimes people say the same thing and mean very different things. And we need to be a bit more alert to that, I think, than we sometimes have been. Some Christians, therefore, are adamant that the Christian ideal of marriage is and can only be between one man and one woman, and that it provides the proper context in which children are conceived and raised, whilst others understand deep committed relationships to be of themselves God-given and marriage-like, regardless of whether they're between one man and one woman, two women, two men, or possibly other constellations. But within those general categories, people have very varied opinions. People may argue that marriage is properly between one man and one woman and hold that Christian marriage is fundamentally a relationship between two people who are equal in the sight of God. Or they may argue that marriage is properly between one man and one woman and hold that the proper understanding of Christian marriage is that the woman, whilst equally beloved to God, is in the created ordinance subordinate to the man. And even within that position, there are different views. Does subordination mean obedience or does it mean submission? I have a colleague who's a university chaplain who has encountered young women who want to change the words of the marriage vows, which in the Church of England is actually illegal, to allow them to promise to submit to their husband rather than to obey him. So when people say, we think marriage is between one man and one woman, I want to push back and say, well, what do you mean by that? What do you mean by that kind of relationship? Because actually it's a much smaller step from saying this is a relationship of equals from there to, I think, supporting the idea of same-sex marriage as a Christian institution than it is from a relationship of unequals. And one of the things I'm going to argue in this paper is that there's been a major shift over the last 100 years from seeing marriage fundamentally as a hierarchical institution to seeing marriage fundamentally as an institution of equality or a relationship of equality. So what I want to say right from the beginning is that even if we agree, which I'm not, most of us here wouldn't, I suspect, that it's marriages between one man and one woman, people hold very different views about what kind of relationship that is. And I think one of the things that we could usefully do in the church is to probe a bit more when people say, this is what it should be. Well, what do you actually mean by that? What kind of relationship are you looking at? I want to begin my content, though, by thinking about what Scripture says about marriage. We might begin with Genesis, and as you, those of you who have read the Church of England's report, which came out last year, Men and Women in Marriage, will realise that that is precisely where that report wanted to begin. Drawing on Genesis 1, 26 to 28, which I hope you can read, the report argues that marriage is an expression of the human nature which God has willed for us and which we share. And although marriage, it says, may fall short of God's purposes in many ways and be the scene of many human weaknesses, it receives the blessings of God and is included in his judgment that creation is very good. Genesis 1:31. This passage, the creation of men and women in our likeness, male and female, he created them, has been often been read, and Men and Women in Marriage does this, to present the complementarity of male and female as a fundamental aspect of the created order. Martha Meyer has argued that this is about saying that men and women are both necessary to encompass the full image of God, and that this is affirmed also in the New Testament. She also wants to take that further, that men and women in relationship are reflective of the creative, generative, and governing aspects of God. And I think that's really important. Men and women in relationship are reflective of the creative aspects of God. Part of this is about saying that marriage is about procreation. If we read it this way, Genesis offers a vision of marriage as the means by which male and female human beings are drawn into and share in God's creative purposes. Men and Women and Marriage goes on to affirm, we share with many animal species the sexual differentiation of male and female, serving the tasks of reproduction and the nurture of children. But we do more than share it, we build on it to enhance the bond between the sexes culturally. To flourish as individuals, we need a society, says the report, in which men and women relate well to each other. I wouldn't deny any of that, but it doesn't seem to me that necessarily implies that marriage has to be in between one man and one woman. And many of you may realise that I was one of the drafters of that report, and several of us were trying to argue for a rather more open argument within that process. So the creation stories do offer us, I think, a vision of complementarity between men and women, not only in the increase of humankind, but also in ensuring the well-being and the flourishing of creation. And I do think that's something important to hold on to. I don't think the complementarity aspect of it is necessarily essential, but the sense that relationships are part of how we actually ensure that creation is well looked after. What I don't think that gives us is a blueprint in the Old Testament for a biblical view of marriage rooted in complementarity or mutuality and simply focused on the procreation and nurture of children. Because in reality, the Old Testament's depiction of marriage is much more complex than this. This is just one aspect, one rather idealized aspect, of what we find in the Old Testament. Much of the Old Testament, and particularly the legal codes of the Pentateuch, and I remember writing an essay about the legal codes of the Pentateuch, women in the legal codes of the Pentateuch when I was studying Old Testament, and I have to say it was an incredibly depressing experience. Marriage is basically seen as a contract involving, well, I have here actually written a man and a woman, but actually I think it's a contract really involving two men in which the woman is something that is passed from one to the other. Marriageable women in the Old Testament, in the legal codes, it seems to me, tend to be seen largely as the property, first of their father, or a marriageable woman is the property of her father to be passed on to her husband. Excuse me, sorry. I'll try not to cough into the microphone. Deuteronomy 22, 28 to 29, for instance, and there are many other examples, suggests that a man, or instructs that a man who rapes a young unmarried woman who is not engaged to another man must marry her. Exodus 22, 16 to 17 covers the case when a young woman has been seduced by an older man. He has either to marry her or at least to pay her father her bride price. These texts may seem irrelevant to us in our modern world, but I remember doing a Bible study with women in South Africa where lobola is part of the way that their marriages are negotiated, and they had very strong feelings about to whom bride price should be paid at any given time. So in some societies, these texts are still very relevant indeed. I think what's important for our society is to notice that family honour is what is key here. It is marriage in this part of the Old Testament, in the Deuteronomic codes, is about the regulation of inheritance and about the care of as yet unborn children and about men knowing who their children are. Women don't have that problem. Women know that they are the mothers of the children they are born. I don't have any children, but all women I have met who have gone through pregnancy and childbirth know whether that they are the mother of that child. It's much harder for men to know which children they are the father of. I'm making assumptions here, of course. But you know, if this is about controlling inheritance, this is about saying, if I have made this woman pregnant, then I am actually responsible for her child, but that child also needs to be acknowledged to be mine. What's being depicted in these codes is certainly a relationship between men and women, but also one of the interesting things about the Old Testament is that it's not actually obviously a monogamous relationship. There are quite a lot of instructions about what to do if you want another wife, or it is always wives, and about what to do if the husband of somebody dies, and what to do with that woman. Often she's then associated as another wife into an elder brother's family. What I wanted to say is that the Old Testament, this aspect of the Old Testament, is nothing like modern Western understandings of marriage as a relationship between two equals. It's much more about regulation and control, and that is a key aspect of marriage, I'd want to argue, through history. It's about regulating inheritance, it's about regulating relationships between between families. It is about the relationship between the two people, but it's much more about how society comes to be structured. It is, however, the case, I think, that Christianity inherits, by the time we get to the Hellenistic period, by the time we get into the period in which Christianity is emerging, we are looking in the Eastern Mediterranean at marriage as monogamous. The Gospels, the letters of Paul, the New Testament household codes all present marriage between one man and one woman. The household codes, and I'm not going to put them all up, we're going to look briefly at Ephesians and then at 1 Peter, offer, however, a vision of marriage which is explicitly hierarchical, in that the wife is said to be rightly subordinate to her husband, although it's also a relationship with mutual responsibilities, in that a husband is reminded of his duty to love his wife. Now, people who work in this area tell me that reminder that the husband has a duty to love his wife is actually quite unusual in the household codes of the period. The household codes tend to be more hierarchical without that love. The interesting Christian element that seems to be coming in through the Christian household codes or the New Testament household codes is that aspect of loving mutuality. However, it is loving mutuality within the context of a relationship in which the woman is meant to be and intended to be seen as subordinate to her husband. And I think that understanding of marriage persists through much of Christian history, as we're going to see. And a lot of the contemporary discussion around headship, which has implications not just for family relationships, but for arguments, for instance, around the ordination of women or around the discussion of the admission of women to the episcopate, is based on precisely this kind of understanding, that the order of creation, the natural order of creation, as it is replicated also properly in marriage, is about a hierarchical relationship. The man is head of has headship over the woman in the same way that Christ has headship over the church. So these texts, which actually come from a Stoic background, not from a Christian background at all, have had a really strong influence in understandings both of marriage and of the role of women and the way that those intertwine. It is worth noting, I think, however, that we don't read them, we tend to read them rather selectively. So I've given you one for Ephesians 5 there. We get one of 1 Peter 3, excuse me. Remember, I'm not speaking to a microphone there. 1 Peter 3, 1 to 7, a very similar message that wives should accept the authority of their husbands. So another hierarchical household code follows immediately, which we often find cited in these discussions, follows immediately on from a text which we don't often find cited these days, but which we would have found cited frequently in the anti-slavery debates in the 19th century, or the 18th and 19th century, as an argument for the Christian support for slavery. 1 Peter, these household codes are put together in a context in which the whole household is being regulated, and the whole household does not just include men and women and children, but also includes slaves. So when we read these texts about hierarchical relationships between men and women, we need to place those in the context of a society which is thinking about a household in a much bigger context. And I think it's really interesting that we tend to find 1 Peter 3, 1 to 7 these days being read out of context from 1 Peter 2, 18 to 21. We're not finding the advocates of headship arguing also for the return to slavery. And we might want to think about just what's going on there in terms of how different parts of the Bible are being read, perhaps with more emphasis on particular areas than on others. As I've said, the household codes were not originally Christian texts. They're drawn from the teachings of Stoic philosophers, who in themselves then draw on the understanding of Aristotle's understanding of the relationship between men and women. You can say that in many ways these scriptural texts, these scriptural household codes, or the scripturalization, if to coin a word, of these household codes, the canonization of these household codes, represents precisely the assimilation of cultural norms of the time into Christianity. This is Christianity drawing on the way in which society was structured at the time. This is not something that just comes in from nowhere. This is part of the discussions that were going on in the Roman Empire about how men and women should relate to each other. So we're seeing here Christianity in the biblical period drawing on the cultural norms in the society in which it finds itself. And there's been some really interesting work done on marriage in the Gospel of Mark, where one of my German colleagues looked at different understandings of marriage as exemplified by divorce law in the first century, and found that actually what's happening is one particular understanding of marriage. And that there were actually other understandings. For instance, in there were areas in the Roman Empire in the first century where both men and women can petition for divorce. There were other areas where women can only petition for divorce with the permission of their husbands. And there were other areas where women can't petition for divorce at all. That's different sorts of thinking about marriage. So actually, even in the first century, we do have there is a particular cultural norm that's being drawn in, but it is a selective cultural norm. Reflecting on marriage in the New Testament at an Affirming Catholicism conference, which we ran in January to look at the history of marriage with a series of specialists in that period, in different periods, New Testament scholar Joran Oakland reflected on which aspects of Old Testament law were taken into the New Testament. She identified that it was rules about sex and gender, including purity laws, which tended to be retained, whilst other laws in the Old Testament, such as those relating to clothing, tended not to be. Joran also highlighted the way in which sibling relationships actually form much of the thinking about relationships within the New Testament. And much of the writing about sibling relationships then gets carried over into how modern theology started to think about marriage. 1 Corinthians 13, for instance, it's not exactly about sibling relationships either, but it's not actually directed at thinking about marriage. She came to the conclusion that the New Testament is about being part of the kingdom of God, and everything we do has to be measured against that standard. And she concluded, the New Testament texts don't fit easily with modern understandings of marriage and the nuclear family. She asked a question, which I will leave you to ponder with just for a second. Can you name one New Testament family which is presented in the New Testament in such a way that the father of the family would not have any difficulty in getting a position in a conservative congregation? We tried quite hard to come up with one, but it's not very easy. What I'm trying to say here is that the New Testament, the early church clearly knew marriage. We can see that from the New Testament, but that marriage was not a Christian institution. Marriage is an institution which is taken into the structures of the Christian church because it is an institution that already exists in society. Greek, Roman, and Jewish marriage practices all influence developing Christian approaches to and understandings of marriage. And we see this particularly in 1 Corinthians 7, where Paul is grappling with the Christianizing of a pagan institution, and also an institution he's really not very convinced about because he thinks it distracts attention from following Christ. If Christians really have to marry, he says, I've got a little quote from Joran there, I will skip over that one. And I've also got, if you want to listen to the Affirming Catholicism lectures, we haven't published them yet, but they are available on the Affirming Catholicism website, so that's just a push for that. 1 Corinthians 7. Paul grappling with the Christianization of a pagan institution, and really one that he's not at all sure is a really good idea. If people are going to get married, he thinks, if they really feel they have to get married because they can't control their sexual urges in any other way, then they should do that. But he'd really much rather that they didn't. It's also instructive to look at his instructions or his thoughts on those married to non-Christian partners. If the spouse consents, he says, and this is the second text on this slide, then they should stay together. For the unbelieving husband is made holy through his wife. And I think this is actually on the next slide. Yes, here we go. The unbelieving husband is made holy through his wife, and the unbelieving wife is made holy through her husband. If it weren't for that, then your children would be unclean. But as it is, they are actually holy. Note that these are marriages not conducted through Christian ceremonies. They're marriages which have been conducted under Greek or Roman law, which are made holy by the presence of a Christian partner. And I think that may be quite helpful to us in thinking about how a church to respond to the whole debate around civil partnerships, around same-sex marriage. If we can actually perhaps take a step back from thinking about marriage as a Christian institution and think of it as an institution which is actually, in a sense, a civic institution, which has ramifications far beyond the Christian community, and which is then made holy by the participation of Christians, we hope at least. Also at the Affirming Catholicism Conference, Callie Hammond explored the way in which Roman law about marriage served to stabilise the inheritance of property through ensuring legitimate children and thus stabilising society. And that is very similar, I think, to what we observe in the codes of the Old Testament. For Augustine, she pointed out, affection, procreation and sacrament were the purposes of marriage. Marriage served to stabilise society, although, as she points out, this is not what most people think they're doing when they're getting married, and it certainly wasn't in Augustine's day either. For the couple, it was for Augustine, ideally the sexual expression of friendship. Callie Point, and I think that's a really helpful way of thinking about what marriage might be, which is clearly not simply related to the gender of those people who were engaging in the sexual expression of friendship. Callie pointed out that it's a long jump from Augustine's affection, procreation, and sacrament to the modern thinking about marriage, which is increasingly about stable, faithful, and loving relationships. And she suggested or argued that the two paradigms are so far apart that we have to make a case for how we get from one to the other. That's a way of saying, I think, that it's quite difficult sometimes in this debate to see how the institution that we're talking about is the same, or whether it's the same, as the institution that we were talking about in the early church or in the Reformation. What we think marriage is, what Augustine thought marriage was, yes, it was about one man and one woman, but it was also about one man and one woman in a particular social context, particular cultural context. Our social and cultural context has shifted, our legal context has shifted, and that changes, I think, what we think are the priorities of marriage. It's worth noting that the legal aspects of marriage long remained a civic or a civil affair. As late as the 10th century, or even after the 10th century, marriages were not primarily conducted in church. There might be a Christian ceremony, but it was conducted outside the church door to recognize that the marriage relationship was something that sat uneasily between the church and the world. It wasn't until the 13th century in the Western Church that a priest was held to preside over the ceremony, and thus, in some senses, to use an anachronistic term from the Reformation in England, to solemnise matrimony. But it was still recognised, and in the theology of sacrament, for those who think that marriage is a sacrament, it is still recognised that the sacrament is made by the couple in their relationship to God. The priest does not enact the sacrament in any way. Couples right up to the Reformation in Western Europe could still marry through mutual agreement without the involvement of a priest, and the church would recognise those marriages. And a lot of what's going on in the Reformation is an attempt to stop what is seen as secret marriage. These sorts of marriages are often known as secret marriages, and to make marriage be something public, and make marriage be something done in front of the congregation, with a congregation present. And you see that we have a historical remnant of that in the calling of banns. Marriage is the declaration of the intention to marry is a public event, and people are to be asked if this is what they want to do. And people have to be asked if there's any problems about this. That's partly about trying to find out if this person has married somebody else beforehand. To go back to the early church, though, we do see the early church definitely starting to develop a theology of marriage, often based on the exegesis of Ephesians 5:32. And this is an important text, because this is where the idea that marriage is sacrament comes from. That word in verse 32 that is translated mystery in this translation, in the Vulgate is sacramentum. In the Greek it's mysterion, and that is translated then as sacramentum in the Latin, and feeds into the idea that marriage is a sacrament. It's actually the only use of the term sacramentum in the entire New Testament Vulgate. Ephesians 5, as we can see here, presents marriage as a model for the relationship between church and God, or the relationship between church and Christ. And that, combined with the fact that marriage is clearly a very important social and societal institution, means that Christians are starting to think about how do we talk about marriage theologically. Christian understandings develop to see it as an expression of God's love, to see it as the context in which sexuality was properly lived out, the context in which procreation, therefore, should properly take place, and in which children should be reared and nurtured. However, and we might say perhaps despite Augustine's best efforts, because Augustine really did think that procreation was really important for marriage, because he thought that marriage was about producing the right number of the elect, so that heaven would, when it came to the end of time, heaven would be filled with the right number of people. Procreation and children have never actually been seen as essential to marriage. There's never been a suggestion, for instance, that women beyond childbearing age should not marry. And even before the introduction of clerical celibacy, there were quite strong moves to say that married priests should not have children, which is sort of a way in the early world of saying actually married priests should not be indulging in sexual intercourse, since without contraception, there was few other ways of ensuring you didn't have children. There's a whole discussion around celibate marriage in the early church, an ongoing discussion which goes on right into the 7th or the 8th centuries, which indicates a real ambiguity about attitudes towards sex. And we can see that picked up, and I'm going to come back to that, in the Middle Ages around discussions about celibacy and the praise of asceticism. Important to see also is that Christians in this period increasingly emphasise the need for both partners to consent freely to the marriage, although it has to be said that particularly amongst the elite, arranged marriages clearly continued, and we have all sorts of examples of people being children being contracted to marriage for marriage at the age of two or three, particularly amongst leading particularly amongst leading families. Two other things shifted in the medieval period. Marriage came to be defined as insoluble except by death, particularly in the Western Church, based on the readings of Matthew 5 and Matthew 19. It came to be seen as restricted by questions of consanguinity, so who are you related to by blood? And I think we can see good reasons for that. We know that inbreeding is a bad idea. Geneticists have proved that to us. And that, I think, is a recognition of that. But also marriage restrictions by affinity, that is, who are your in-laws? So you're not supposed to marry your brother-in-law's sister, for instance, or your sister-in-law's brother. And in the church, restrictions by spiritual affinity. That means that you can't marry the child of your godfather or the child of your godmother. So there's no actual relationship there at all for either of those second ones. This is about saying these people are too closely related. This is partly about making sure that marriage is trying to be outside the particular circle. It has to be said that these rules became a real money spinner for the church in the later Middle Ages. All of us here, I'm sure, are aware of the fact that Henry VIII is one of the wonderful examples of this. When he married Catherine of Aragon, he was actually marrying somebody to whom he was not allowed to get married by these rules, because Catherine of Aragon had already been married to his elder brother. Whether consummated or not remains a huge question. But the fact is that Henry VIII had to pay a lot of money to be allowed to marry Catherine of Aragon, and then when he didn't want to marry her sometime later, the Pope refused to undispense the dispensation he'd given. But it wasn't just Henry VIII. The church was, in the late medieval period, was raising a lot of money around, particularly around spiritual affinity laws. And I think we can see here that the way in which these things shift. Consanguinity, we would still say, actually, marrying your first cousin is probably not a great idea. It's not illegal, but it's probably genetically not a great idea, and you certainly ought to check out a few things before you do it. In-laws marriage, now much less of an issue. Not marrying the child of your godfather, I don't think any of us would have a problem with that, unless the godfather happens to be the uncle. Marriage was then was shifting and changing. The church was starting to control it, trying to control it. And in 1215, when the definitive list of seven sacraments is articulated by the Fourth Lateran Council, marriage is included on that list. It's been on and off the list of sacraments through the medieval period. And when we get to the Protestant Reformation, it will come off the list again for Protestants. But it gets definitely on there in 1215, which means really that you've got most people only have access to six sacraments at any given time. Women certainly only have access to six, only the fact that women at this period can't be ordained. All this discussion of the Middle Ages, though, needs to be put in the context of the fact that marriage is not the only form of life recognised for Christians, and indeed it is seen in many ways in late antiquity and in the medieval period as an inferior form of life. Paul's letters, and particularly 1 Corinthians 7, witnessed to a real ambiguity in the assessment of marriage. Was it not wiser to remain celibate? The tension between the valuing of marriage and the valuing of celibacy was heightened from the 4th century by the popularity of asceticism, and it forms the background to a lot of the writing about Christian marriage, as I said, in late antiquity and the medieval period. Augustine did believe that marriage would have existed in paradise. Not all theologians did, but he thought that in paradise, sexual intercourse would have been a rational process governed and controlled by reason. And for Augustine, the lack of control in sex, which came about with the fall, was the means by which sin had been transmitted. That becomes very important in the Western Church. Marriage is seen as necessary for the fallen world, and it is seen as the proper place for sexual intercourse for those who can't control themselves, but it is also the means of passing on original sin. We can see this in lots of writings, but let me just give you one example. Jerome, writing to the young virgin Eustochium, about the drawbacks of marriage, such as pregnancy, the crying of infants, the torture caused by a rival, very realistic, Jerome always, the cares of household management, and all those fancied blessings which death at last cuts short. Virginity, as he thought, as Paul had before him, was much to be preferred. And it has to be said that actually for a good number of women in the early church who didn't, or right through into the modern period, who didn't particularly want to die in childbirth, virginity could also seem quite attractive, I think, for that reason. The perception that marriage was second best, and in particular that sex was inherently sinful, coloured the church's attitudes towards marriage throughout the medieval period. This may have been difficult for both men and women, but it tends to have been women who wrote about it. Bridget of Sweden, for instance, and her husband Ulf Gudmason were an upper-class couple who both felt called to follow Christ, but who were both expected by their families to get married and to have children in order to safeguard the dynastic inheritance. So you have a couple here who believe very strongly that their true vocation as Christians is to celibacy, but they have 8 children. They try to live a celibate life when they can, but they do have 8 children. And you get another one, Marjorie of Kemp. If you've ever read Marjorie of Kemp, she has this real pull. She actually really likes sex. And she keeps saying in her book, I just really enjoy my husband, which is wonderful. But actually, I know, Jesus, you're calling me to be celibate. She has 13 children. And in the end, though, she is given permission to live as a virgin. And then she puts on a white robe and she goes off and goes around and becomes a pilgrim, really, but she's very sad about losing not just her relationship to her husband, but her sexual relationship to her husband. The point I'm wanting to make is that marriage in the medieval period was seen as inferior, and men and women who wanted to follow Christ needed to think about how they lived their lives in order to allow them to do that, and there could be very, very conflicting expectations on them. And as I said, I think the prospect of dying in childbirth, which must have been the most common cause of death for adult women until the modern period, was probably also a reason why celibacy proved attractive to Christian women, both in the early church and the medieval period. Quite apart from the fact that the only way you could get an education was usually to join either a monastery or a nunnery, so that's another, you know, if you wanted to be educated, you were going to be celibate, you were not going to be married. Within all of this, the fundamental assumption is that marriage is a relationship of inequality between men and women. Thomas Aquinas' argument for equality, it has, in a wonderful title of an article, been was for an unequal relationship between equals. And I think that tension, we'll see that coming out again in Luther. Assumptions about the respective place of men and women in marriage, as expressed in the household codes, were, as I've said, related to Aristotelian or Galenic biological understandings of sexual differentiation. And these persisted well into the early modern or even into the modern period. They assumed that the rational, warm male was opposed to the emotional, cold female. And for Aristotle, and some of you may be really glad to know this, guys, for Aristotle, truly masculine men could be identified by the fact that their intellect had burned the hair off the top of their heads, causing baldness. So you guys with no hair, you're the real men. In procreation, the active principle was contributed by the male, and the female's role was passive. She provided a nurturing body in which the baby could grow. So interesting implications for that for our thinking about how the doctrine of the Trinity is conceived, but that is a very different question. But that biological understanding of procreation underlay definitions of the proper social role for men and women, both within and without marriage. Men were active and engaged in public life. They were the speakers, if you like. Women were to be passive, nurturing, with a focus on the private. The Protestant Reformation picks up on these ideas whilst also according marriage a new importance. Luther and the other reformers of Protestantism were particularly critical of the way in which celibacy had been privileged, but privileged in an extremely hypocritical way. A church which required clerical celibacy, but turned a blind eye to the living arrangements of priests, except to fine them when a child was born. And there are really interesting reflections. There's a really interesting reflection by Katharina Schutz-Zell, who was one of the first women in Germany to marry a priest, and she's the only one that we know about who wrote about it, where she reflects on how the diocese has been profiting from the breakdowns in celibacy amongst its priests. And that wasn't just in the Diocese of Strasbourg, that's quite clearly the pattern across Western Europe. Luther affirmed that the tasks of caring for children should be shared by both parents, and he's quite firm about that, and he's quite rude about people who think that men shouldn't change nappies. But he nonetheless taught that a woman's true vocation lay in marriage, in her companionship with and her obedience to her husband, and in the bearing and bringing up of children. Women who died in childbirth, Luther thought, were truly following Christ. That is their crucifixion. And there's a very moving bit in the in his treatise on sacraments in 1520, where he's talking about a situation where both the mother and the child are clearly going to die in childbirth. And at what stage can you baptize the baby? Can you baptize the baby when only a foot or a hand is sticking out of has emerged from the womb? And he says, I'm really not sure about this. I don't know what we do, but we just have to do the best pastoral thing we can. That is clearly a situation in which both mother and child are expected to die. This is a common experience at the time. For Luther, then, the obedience of a wife to her husband, the subordination of women to men, were part of the natural order given under the law to which marriage belonged. And Luther is very clear, marriage for him is not a sacrament, it's part of the civic order, but it's part of a civic order that needs to be lived out in a Christian way. The gospel transcended this order so that in questions of salvation for Luther, men and women stood equal before God. So Luther, very much like Aquinas, equal but in equal but unequal. In England, from 1549, the Book of Common Prayer listed three causes for which matrimony was ordained. Actually, I've given you a bit more than just the causes here. I think it's worth noticing that the preface thinks that it's an honourable estate ordained by God. And there we have our three causes. First, it's ordained for the procreation of children, to be brought up in the fear and nurture of God and to the praise of his holy name, so procreation and bringing up of children. Secondly, it's ordained as a remedy against sin, to avoid fornication, so that such people who have not the gift of continency may marry. That's a real resonance still with 1 Corinthians 7. You know, there's still a hint in 1549, well, in the prayer book, that actually if you could get on without marriage, you'd be better off. If you can manage without sex, then if you can be continent, otherwise get married. And keep yourself an undefiled member of Christ's body. So there's still a sense here of being defiled by being married. And thirdly, it's ordained for mutual society help and comfort that the one ought to have of the other, both in prosperity and adversity, into which holy estate these two persons present come now to be joined, we imagine. Procreation, the managing of lust, and companionship. Those are the three aspects which shape early modern understandings of marriage, and they continue to shape our understanding today. But I think it's really important to see these three aims of marriage, which we've heard cited quite a lot in the recent debate, in the context of the rest of the BCP. Something we don't look at so often is the advice on the homily. And the advice on the homily is very clear that what we are supposed to be looking at here is marriage lived out in the way that Ephesians 5 and 1 Peter have seen it. So, all you that are married should listen to what Scripture says about how husbands should comport themselves towards their wives, so about loving, about being heirs together of the grace of life. So this is very much picking up on that aspect of respect, mutual honour. And then for wives, the duty of the wife, hear and learn your duties towards your husbands. St. Paul, in the aforementioned epistle to the Ephesians, teaches you thus, wives, submit yourselves unto your own husbands as unto the Lord. St. Peter also doth instruct you very well, thus saying, ye wives, be in subjection to your own husbands, that if any obey not the word, they also may be without the word. If any obey not the word, they also may without the word be won into the conversation of their wives. So you're supposed to be converting your husband to proper Christianity, so that's what Paul's thinking, but very much the message of subordination. It worries me slightly when I see apparently innocuous motions before the General Synod calling for us to hold on to the theology of the Book of Common Prayer's views of marriage, because I think most people tend to think it's about this. And most people would actually say, probably with the possible question of procreation, well, the first two question mark, but the third one, yes. But actually, it's not just about that. It's also about this whole question of subordination. That is part of the theology of the Book of Common Prayer. And I think that leaves us with quite an interesting question in the Church of England and in other parts of the Anglican Communion which still hold to the Book of Common Prayer. As Hannah Clue put it at our meeting, how can we express a theology of marriage that is true both to the liturgical traditions of the Church of England and to modern perspectives on what marriage is and should be? I think that is part of what the ASB was trying to do, to hold on to a liturgy but to move it into a different understanding of marriage. And we do see in the ASB marriages given that the husband and wife may comfort and help each other, so the mutual companionship being moved up here. it's given that they, in delight and tenderness, they may know each other in love. So a positive side of the control of lust here, so actually bodily union. And it's given us the foundation of family life. And I think that phrasing was very carefully thought about in 1980 to acknowledge that not all couples are going to have children, but that you can still have a family life. Speaking as a childless, half of a childless couple myself, I found that really a really helpful way of thinking about it. And I think that's also what common worship is trying to do, to move, to hold on to the tradition, the liturgical tradition, but to think again about what we mean. And in common worship as well, and in the ASB, I think we're seeing a much more egalitarian, equality-focused understanding of marriage. I'd want to concur with Hannah Clew, though, who was talking about the Reformation at our conference, saying it's not that we don't know what we think about gay marriage. The problem is that we don't know what we think about marriage at all. We do not know, she said, what we think the purpose of Christian marriage in contemporary society is. And I think that is one of the major problems. Is it about equal relationships? Is it about shaping society? Is it about looking at, about children somehow? What do we actually think it is? I think the major shifts in the understanding of marriage, and I am going to be moving towards the end, really start to take shape as society starts to move and to change in the 18th and 19th centuries. I'm going to compress an awful lot of history into just a paragraph here, so I apologise for that. But really, you see some major shifts under industrialisation, particularly around seeing an increasing differences between the lives of the working poor, in which men, women and often children were working to survive, and those of the middle and upper classes, in which women could remain at home, and those differences become much more pronounced. This Protestant ideal of woman as subordinate, I think probably helped to define the image of the angel of the house, which became really widely established during the 19th century, and which I think fed into a very romantic understanding of marriage, as the man goes out, is out there and sort of earning the money and bringing it home, and the woman is maintaining this comfortable household and this wonderful place for him to come back to be refreshed. It underlay, and this ideal underlay, many of the arguments for women's suffrage, which were about the civilising influence of women making itself felt in the running of society. And it's interestingly that rhetoric still continues to find itself, find its way into discussions of marriage today. And one of the arguments that I have heard made for the argument that for the reason that marriage has to be between one man and one woman is that men need civilising. Well, okay. And it's very interesting how I have heard groups of men talking about how things changed for them when women entered, for instance, into a senior common room, or indeed into the House of Bishops. God, you know, let's hope it's going to actually happen fairly quickly. But actually, nobody seems to ever ask women what happens to groups of women when men arrive in them. And I would say, you know, we don't suddenly descend into a brawling mass. It's not quite that bad. It just depends on the men. And I suspect, actually, really, it depends on the women as well. What's important, and the point of all this, really, is that marriage as an institution also starts to shift and change in the 19th century. And I think you'll hear more about this, certainly in one of the workshops. I think Adrian may say more about this later on as well. The 19th century, for instance, saw significant changes in the legal status of married women. The Married Women's Property Act of 1870 actually made it legally possible for a married woman, to own her own property. Until then, when a woman got married, she surrendered control of all her property to her husband. That changed how women could actually function within marriage. It didn't change the institution in the sense that it wasn't one man or one woman, but it changed assumptions about the relationship within marriage. And it's the beginning, I think, of a recognition that we're moving towards a more egalitarian understanding of marriage. Jeremy Morris pointed out at our conference in January that these changes to legislation made marriage more equal, and they introduce distinctions between civic, civil and canon law into questions of marriage in English and in Scottish law. But he wanted to say that we need to be really careful about absolutising any historical model of marriage and saying this is how it must be. And he also pointed out that it's long ceased to be true for the majority of British citizens that the Church's doctrine of marriage, in its fullest and most complete sense, is what constrains their understanding of what they're entering into when they get married. I think long ceased to be true is probably a euphemism for it's never been true, myself. During the 20th century, you have seen massive shifts in technology, reproductive technology, the introduction of different contraceptive methods, a real shift in the understanding of and the legal requirements around divorce and in the acceptability of divorce. And all of those have changed how we think about marriage and how we experience marriage. Each of them, it might be said, and I think it's important to say, each of those debates has been held to herald the end of marriage as a Christian institution. If you look at debates around the contraception at the Lambeth conferences, everybody's saying, this is the end of marriage as a Christian institution as we know it. Well, actually, that might have been true. If you look about debates about divorce and the remarriage of divorced people in church, people are saying this is the end of marriage as an institution. Funnily enough, people have carried on getting married in church, despite all this institution having constantly come to an end. We've kind of lived and worked with it, but I'm not sure we've done our theology. And I'm particularly not sure we've done our theology around what it actually means that in the Western world, contraception is now so much more available. Access to contraception already made it possible to separate sexual fulfillment from procreation. Modern fertility methods have made that even more the case. And I don't think that we've done enough thinking in the church about what that actually means. One of my students did a survey for she's a URC Scottish Synod student. She did a survey last year, amongst other things. She asked ministers of the URC in Scotland about their experience of couples coming to be married. And several of them said that in the last 20 years, the thing they had most noticed was that 20 years ago, this is Scotland, some of them quite rural, so I'm not sure, I think in London it's probably 20 years ago, it would not have been the case. 20, 25 years ago, 95% of couples coming to be married gave on their paperwork two different addresses. These days, 95% of couples coming to be married give on their paperwork one address. What does that, do we not believe that they're sleeping with each other? You know, I'm sorry, but actually, this idea that there is no sex happening outside marriage is something that we've moved on from a long time ago, and we're not talking about it in the church. I got married when I was 38. I do not believe that my bishop thought I'd never slept with anybody before I met my husband, or before I got married. I just don't believe it. But the Church of England is still tending to act as if this were not the case. And I think we need to talk about that. We need to talk about what it is about a relationship, what it is about the quality of relationships. And that, I think, helps us then to think more openly about what it is we're looking for in relationships that we want to affirm. The question about fertility, I think, is a really interesting one, because, of course, we know throughout history families have existed in which, for one reason or another, children are not either biologically or genetically the offspring of at least one of their nurturing parents. We know about adoptive children, we know about step families, we know about single-parented families, all of whom have long been integrated into society. I have a number of friends, both heterosexual and same-sex couples, who have had children either through with the help of techniques including IVF, artificial insemination, and surrogacy. Some of the parents of those families, as I say, are heterosexual couples. Some of them are multiple couples after divorce or separation. I think a lot of children these days grow up with several sets of parents. I have friends who are gay couples who are parenting as two mothers in one relationship and two fathers in another relationship. Some are single parents. We need to talk about the variety of ways in which procreation is actually happening. And we need to talk about some of the dangers and the difficulties of that, not just for the parents, but also for the children, yes. We do need to talk about that. But that is not just an issue around same-sex couples, and I think it's really wrong in this debate to suggest that it is. Ian McLean argued at our conference in January that the Pilling Report is already behind the times. And he quoted the Archbishop of Canterbury, Archbishop Justin, saying, "The vast majority of people under 35 think not only that what the Church of England is saying is incomprehensible, but also that it is plain wrong and possibly even wicked, and equate it to racism and other forms of gross and atrocious injustice." That was the Archbishop of Canterbury speaking to the Evangelical Alliance in August of 2013. I think he's absolutely right. And I think, though, that we need to be aware of our historical developments and ask, if we ask where does this leave us, I think it leaves us with an understanding of marriage which in the last century has become increasingly focused on the relationship between the partners. And in Christian context, it's become focused on a relationship through which the love of God is being made known in a way we can't fully explain. It's really intriguing that these days 1 Corinthians 13 is probably the most popular reading at weddings. This was a reading which the reformers did not see as suitable for weddings. And it's a reading which is not about marital love at all. I think recognising that marriage as an institution has shifted and changed down the centuries as an important part of, should be an important part of informing our debate. Christian marriage, from its earliest beginnings, has always been rooted in the social context in which it's lived out. It's always been subject to the norms and the expectations of that context, and it has been shaped by the norms and expectations of that context. I think in an era in which the government is taking steps that the church does not always find easy to accept, we may find it helpful to reflect on how Christian marriage has shaped itself to norms in the past. And maybe we need to think again about the way in which the early church dealt with these questions and affirm the way in which Christians in marriage have contributed to and to continue to contribute to the hallowing of a relationship or an institution which in many ways could probably be said to be fundamentally unchristian. Thank you very much.